Sidactic Residency Edition. I am Dr. O'Leary, and today is Friday, December 15th, 2023. For those tuning in for the first time, this is a podcast about psychiatry and neuroscience. I am a fourth-year psychiatry resident who does this in his spare time as a way to structure my own studies. So I actually accomplished something. I'm trying to be accurate and thorough, but no one is keeping me honest but myself, so you should remain skeptical of me too. If you want to give me feedback, you can go to sidactic.com and fill out the form there. I always point out as well that the content in this podcast should in no way be confused with the opinions of the federal government, the Department of Defense, the Defense Health Agency, or the Lakin, Kansas Chamber of Commerce. It is my own opinion. Full stop. About a month ago, I decided to do an episode on antipsychotics, and this first led me down a rabbit hole of dopaminergic networks in the brain, including the mesolimbic, mesocortical, nigrostriatal, and my favorite one to say, the tuberoinfundibular pathway. Next, I got distracted by the neuroscience of extrapyramidal side effects of our antipsychotics, especially how blocking D2 receptors interacts with other neurotransmitter systems in the dorsal striatum, such as the systems that regulate serotonin, acetylcholine, and glutamate release, and this can dysregulate muscle tone and movements. Also, over long periods of time, this kind of dysregulation results in neuronal adaptations that can contribute to the development of something called tardive dyskinesia. See my last episode for a discussion on that. My last episode, though, was entirely too long, so I'm going to keep this one shorter. Frequently, I've complained that the terms typical and atypical, or first-generation and second-generation antipsychotics were not very helpful. And when I give, like, chalk talks to junior residents and interns or medical students about antipsychotics, this is one of the first things that I usually say. It is not whether or not they're typical or atypical. It is the relative affinities for different receptors that make the difference between these drugs. Also, chlorpromazine, the very first antipsychotic drug, resembles many atypicals, at least as much as it resembles other first-generation antipsychotics. A few weeks ago, I was lucky enough to encounter a paper that was published in April of 2023 by McCutcheon et al. It's in Biological Psychiatry, and it was titled Data-Driven Taxonomy for Antipsychotic Medication, a New Classification System. They used a machine learning technique, which is just basically a form of artificial intelligence, to classify antipsychotics based on their receptor affinities and whether or not they were agonists or antagonists or partial agonists. Then they compared these groups to reported symptom incidents in the literature, and they found that membership in a group predicted, at least to a reasonable degree, the therapeutic effects and the side effects that it has. So I'm going to use this paper as kind of a springboard to discuss particular antipsychotics. First, let me review the groups that these researchers identified in their analysis. There were four major clusters of similarity based on three principal components that explained, I think they said, like 65% of the variation in the data. They called these clusters 1, 2, 3, and 4 in no really meaningful order. But they also gave them some meaningful names based on the shared receptor affinities that grouped them together. The groups are 1, muscarinic, 2, adrenergic, low dopaminergic, 3, serotonergic, dopaminergic, and 4, just dopaminergic. Let's get deeper into what all that means. Group 1, the muscarinic group. It's called this because its members, in addition to doing other things, are antagonists at acetylcholine muscarinic receptors M2 through M5, And, or they are M1 agonists or weak antagonists at M1. Its members include first generation antipsychotics like chlorpromazine, which was the very first antipsychotic, and loxapine, as well as clozapine, the first second generation antipsychotic, along with olanzapine and quetiapine. Both olanzapine and quetiapine, by the way, were developed in an effort to try to find an alternative to clozapine, because clozapine was very effective, but also caused agranulocytosis and ultimately the death of many of the patients. Medications in this cluster, the muscarinic cluster, also tend to cause orthostatic hypotension. They're more sedating than other medications, and with long-term use, they have high rates of metabolic side effects like hyperlipidemia and hyperglycemia and weight gain. That was group one. Group two, termed the adrenergic/low dopaminergic group, consists of aripiprazole, brexpiprazole, cariprazine, acinapine, lurasidone, and ziprasidone. The authors report that this group is characterized by, quote, low dopaminergic antagonism and a lack of muscarinic or serotonergic antagonism, but significant adrenergic antagonism and dopamine D2 partial agonism, unquote. I expected aripiprazole, brexpiprazole, and cariprazine to group together because these are the partial agonists of D2 and also at 5-HT1A. But it was surprising to find like ziprasidone, lurasidone, and acinapine with them. I should point out that lurasidone in this analysis had a lot of missing data, so that might be one of the reasons why it ended up there. But one notable commonality of this group is that all of the members of this group are also partial agonists at 5-HT1A, which is unique. It's different from other groupings. When you look at the side effect profile, group 2 is known to cause less weight gain or no weight gain and have smaller effects on lipid profiles than the first group or the third group that I'm going to talk about next. Looking at the heat maps that were included in the paper, it also appeared that this group had lower side effect profiles really in almost every category reported. The catch for group 2 is that they were reportedly also less effective at controlling both positive and negative symptoms of psychosis than the other groups. So along with fewer side effects, you might also get less overall effectiveness for target symptoms. Group 3 is the serotonergic/dopaminergic group. Its members include fluphenazine, haloperidol, paliperidone and risperidone, and perphenazine. These meds group together because of similar and significant serotonergic and dopaminergic antagonism without the significant overlap with other groups in their receptor profiles. So this appeared to be really the most diverse group out there, group 3. I would not have expected that like haloperidol would fall into this group, based on like the relatively limited serotonergic activity that I've seen reported for it. Despite this serotonergic activity, which I have been told like reduces EPS or extrapyramidal symptoms, this group was associated with high levels of dystonias, along with significant Parkinsonism and tardive dyskinesia, and substantial rates of postural hypotension and a lot of weight gain. So even though group 3 included risperidone and paliperidone, which themselves have like a reputation for causing prolactinemia, as a whole, the group fell out only second in its propensity to cause prolactinemia. But this is compared with group 4, which comprises the more pure dopamine-blocking agents. So that makes sense. And it brings me to group 4, which is called the dopaminergic group due to relative strong dopamine receptor antagonism combined with few adrenergic effects. This group included medications that are really not commonly used in the United States. Its members were sulpride, amisulpride, molindone, and pimazide, The group members appeared to be more similar to each other than other members of other groups were similar within that group, meaning that the receptor profiles were less diverse, generally because they were more focused on dopamine antagonism alone. So while the group appeared to have higher rates of all the movement disorders, it was less likely as a whole to cause metabolic side effects, with the exception of weight gain. It was also associated with the greatest improvements in both negative and positive symptoms. Before I continue, I don't want to leave the listener thinking that I'm like advocating solely for this particular data-driven grouping of antipsychotic classifications. The taxonomies we use are only as useful as the information that they communicate to us. Just because this principal components analysis was calculated by a machine learning algorithm doesn't mean that the data used were necessarily of good quality or that these groupings are going to give like practice-changing information, but they might. For example, receptor profiles that are not screened would not be included in the data. And the quality of the measurements of receptor affinities themselves might vary from study to study. Still, it's good to do things like this because looking at data from as many perspectives as we can is helpful, especially in letting us know what has strong support and what we really don't know yet, but just think we know. The authors point out that different classification systems use different standards. For example, the predominant neuroscience-based nomenclature, in general, kind of ignored the role of muscarinic receptors in antipsychotic classifications. And this makes it incompetent to inform us about the muscarinic receptor activity. Methods like this one, then the paper I'm reviewing, if given a large and a complete data set, are potentially capable of a much more complete and less biased taxonomic system than the ones we've been given. But given the data that we currently have, I'm going to compare some of the groups that McCutcheon et al. Found. There seem to be some clear signals coming through. One of these signals is in the comparison of group 1 and group 4 in terms of the metabolic side effects. Group 1, that muscarinic group, is associated with the highest rates of metabolic derangements, postural hypotension, and anticholinergic side effects. Just because this group is somewhat unique in its affinity for, say, the cholinergic muscarinic receptors doesn't necessarily mean that this is the mechanism of metabolic derangement, but it is suspicious. Other classes of psychotropics that are anticholinergics also increase weight gain. Tricyclic antidepressants, and especially the anticholinergic SSRIs like paroxetine, are associated with significant weight gain. Some have proposed various mechanisms, including the increase in consumption of sugary beverages due to dry mouth, overall appetite stimulation, reduction of satiation signaling, increased cravings for high-carbohydrate foods, reduced activity due to more sedentary lifestyles caused by that sedation, or just like a reduced overall metabolic rate. Group 4 doesn't touch muscarinic or really histaminergic or serotonergic receptors, and also doesn't cause the same kind of derangements in metabolic activity. So given the broad look at the data, we cannot say that all antipsychotics cause metabolic issues and weight gain. The anti-muscarinic ones almost certainly will cause substantial weight gain, hyperlipidemia, and hyperglycemia, followed by next the anti-serotonergic and dopaminergic ones, the ones in group 3. The low dopamine affinity slash partial agonists of D2, group 2, have the lowest chance of weight gain, but they still have a significant chance for metabolic issues, and it's higher than more purely anti-dopaminergic agents in group 4. Another signal that is coming through is that the antipsychotics that are more specific for dopamine receptors, those in group 4, including sulpride, amisulpride, melinidone, and pimazide, appear to have better efficacy for both positive and negative symptoms of psychosis than all the other groups. Now, let me take amisulpride as an example. It's frequently used in Europe, but in the US it's approved only for nausea, and it's unlikely to ever be approved for psychosis in the US because it's a generic, so no pharmaceutical company is going to kind of waste their time with an application to the FDA for something that they can't own a patent on. It is one of the few antipsychotics that clearly demonstrates efficacy for both the positive and negative symptoms of psychosis. Amisulpride blocks both D2 and D3 receptors, and that's it. I mean, as far as we know for dopamine. There's also some evidence that it may antagonize 5-HT7 receptors from animal studies, but that's really it for its serotonergic activity. It's a very clean drug. It does not bind to muscarinic, histaminergic, or noradrenergic receptors. It also prefers the presynaptic D2 and D3 receptors, which means that at lower doses, it can effectively increase dopamine levels in the synapses and reduce negative symptoms. At higher doses, it will spill over and start blocking the postsynaptic D2 receptors, and this is likely its mechanism for controlling the positive symptoms. The real-world trade-off in group 4, the pure dopamine receptor blocking group, is that the higher incidence of movement disorders and tardive dyskinesia accompanies its effectiveness in controlling positive and negative symptoms. However, it really shares this problem with group 3, the anti-dopaminergic and serotonergic group. Group 3 also has much higher rates of metabolic side effects than group 4. And group 3 has less control of positive or negative symptoms on average than group 4. There is not a single drug in group 4 that is used commonly in the United States. Sulpride and amisulpride are not FDA approved here. Pimazide appears to have a higher than average rate of QT prolongation, which maybe is why people don't use it so much, because it can cause cardiac arrhythmias. So it's rarely used. And Moulinidone kind of fell out of favor for unclear reasons. Maybe just because it was called a first-generation antipsychotic. There is also kind of the effect of drug companies advocating for their new drugs, and this results in excitement for relatively untested drugs that appear to solve our problems because of all the hype. But in the end, once we start using them, they have their own problems we did not anticipate. Maybe you've heard of the Cady trial. The Cady trial is a kind of a famous trial of antipsychotics in the US. It was a large NIMH-funded trial that was meant to answer the question whether or not second-generation antipsychotics were more effective than first-generation antipsychotics. At that point in time, most people kind of just assumed from clinical experience and propaganda that second-generation antipsychotics were more effective and had fewer side effects. The Cady study compared a half a dozen antipsychotics, but it included only one first-generation antipsychotic, perphenazine. In the end, it found no difference in efficacy among the drugs, and this was with 1,500 patients starting the study. Now, the fact that this study is framed as one, comparing first to second generation antipsychotics when it only included one first generation antipsychotic, and two, really a meaningful comparison in the first place is really beyond me. McCutcheon et al., this paper that I'm reporting on today, clearly demonstrates there is really no biological basis for comparing first-generation and second-generation antipsychotics in the first place. Within the groups, they're just different things. Also, what is probably the most important finding of the Cady trial is that 3/4 of the patients discontinued treatment because, well, regardless of which antipsychotic they took, there were significant side effects. Some people give like special pleading to say like, oh, olanzapine was the most effective, but this was not statistically significant. And really, given the huge dropout rate, well, what was it they were actually comparing in the end? In the end, what this new McCutcheon et al. Paper re-demonstrates is that this split between first and second generation or typical and atypical antipsychotics is not particularly predictive of efficacy or side effects. Blanket statements like typical antipsychotics primarily block D2 and atypical antipsychotics primarily or also block 5-HT2A, simply not true. I mean, a focus of their actual measured receptor affinities is more predictive for their effects and side effects, but it's not likely to be sufficient for us to make predictions of their side effects, like, oh, it's in group three, it must do this. I can't merely say that because an antipsychotic, for example, fell into like cluster two, that it won't cause hyperlipidemia. I still need to see the data for that antipsychotic itself. However, having the ability to actually search for associations between receptor affinities and their relationship with different syndromes can and most likely will help us to identify better targets of research for the future. Now, I may get some hate mail for saying this, and you can find a form to submit it at sidactic.com. But the antipsychotics we use the most in the U.S. really appear to be used more because of propaganda from companies and politics than really from actual data. Thank you for listening. I am Dr. O, and this has been an episode of Sidactic, Residency Edition.